Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmakers Show. So today we have a very exciting founder joining us, you know, a founder that was a lawyer, you know, now turned entrepreneur, you know, which I can definitely relate to that. And we're going to be learning quite a bit on how he made that switch, you know, from being a lawyer to now being a founder, you know, to joining the startup world, to ultimately, you know, like what he has seen too when it comes to leadership, because that's something that they're one of the leaders at, funny enough, and some of the changes that they've seen, you know, with COVID and so forth, and especially with some of the pivots when it comes to their business model as well, which I think is going to be all in all very inspiring for all of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Stephen Bailey. Welcome to the show.
So good to be here. Super excited for the conversation.
So originally born and raised in Louisiana, you know, to parents there that were doctors. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Life was great. New Orleans, best city on earth, but it is a fun place to be from. I try to make it back as often as possible. But yeah, born and raised in New Orleans. My family still lives there. My mom and dad are doctors. My mom's a psychiatrist. My dad's a dentist. And so much to their chagrin, I decided to pursue law, which, you know, doctors usually hate. And I, in high school, spent a lot of time debating as my activity. I also did that in college, and that really helped shape my trajectory into law school. So went to Emory for undergrad, went to Yale for law school. And after spending all of that time preparing to be a lawyer and working at a firm that it turns out we share in common, WilmerHale, I figured out after all that I wanted to do something totally different and move into the world of entrepreneurship. So I now define myself as a recovered lawyer. And, you know, I know still probably just enough to commit malpractice at this point.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So in your case, you know, when I guess being a lawyer, you know, what do you think, you know, that opened up for you? You know, when it came now, you know, obviously, even though you left that behind you, I'm sure that there's a lot that you use from that background, from that learning, you know, that you got and that training too, no? So what do you think you took away from with you, you know, from those years as a lawyer and studying law?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think really three things come to mind. So one, Yale was just a really inspiring place with a great network of people that were doing really exciting and interesting things, both inside and outside of the law. So to give you an example, the first company that I left to join, that startup was founded by one law school classmate and funded by another law school classmate, just to give you a sense of the value of those connections. I'd say the second thing was really understanding how to think in a really structured and rigorous way about complex problems. And that was a combination of both what I learned at Yale, as well as my time debating in high school and college. And I would say, in addition to being able to think in a really structured way, being able to see both sides of an issue and understand how to make difficult decisions between competing options. And then the third piece was just the very specific experience that I got at WilmerHale in the venture capital and private equity group. And that's been tremendously helpful as we've gone through various financing rounds. We've raised over $100 million of capital on Meditech Online. And I always appreciate having a working knowledge of the legal side of deal making, which has come in handy at Meditech Online on a number of occasions.
Now, one thing that is crazy here is, and obviously, as I'm also a recovering lawyer, I can relate to it. You know, all the years that you put into studying law, you know, doing the bar, then joining an amazing law firm, one of the best, actually. How was that a journey, you know, of getting to the decision of, hey, I got to leave this career behind and I got to switch gears?
Yeah, it was a really tough decision. And just like you said, I mean, you spent all of this time preparing for a career. And when I went to law school, I had no conception of a potential career in entrepreneurship. So this was not something that was on the back of my mind. If you'd asked me on day one of law school, I was going to go to Yale, I was going to go to a big firm like WilmerHale, I was actually going to be a litigator, likely an appellate litigator, actually won a moot court at Yale. So that was very much the path that I was on. But I find that in life, being open to new possibilities can really be not just career defining, but life defining. And as I started to, you know, I spent a summer at a law firm after my first year of law school as a summer associate, which is something that's pretty common amongst law students. And that was sort of my first inkling that, you know, this is interesting, but it might not be where I want to plant my flag long term. And then separately from that, I started to have conversations with some classmates, one in particular, Thomas Learman, who's one of the co-founders of Gearson Learman Group, who had started Gearson before law school. And so talked about entrepreneurship, met some other folks who were interested, and that sort of planted the initial seed that maybe there was something else out there. Then I went back to a law firm after my second year of law school, and it was really between that second and third year that I got serious about considering, is this really what I want to do? So I had the good fortune of being at a firm like Wilmer that had a diverse practice. And so what I said to myself when I graduated is, instead of going into litigation, I'm going to actually go into private equity and venture capital, because that felt like an easier way to transition. And it just so happened that one of the law school classmates that I was talking to was thinking about starting a business, and I ended up introducing him to Thomas, who was the initial investor in that business, Frontier Strategy Group. So that's sort of how it happened. My decision to actually leave and say, I'm walking out of the law firm and I'm going to be working for a startup from my kitchen table, you know, leave on a Friday, work at the kitchen table on a Monday, was driven fundamentally by a conversation that I had with a good mentor at the law firm, a guy by the name of David Sylvester. And I was going back and forth, and he said, look, I've done a lot of deals for a lot of entrepreneurs. I assumed at some point that I would leave and I would join one of those companies, and I kind of never did. And I always have a piece of me that wishes that I had. And what he sort of said is like, look, you're young. The firm is always going to be. But what I ultimately took from that, and as I went through a lot of soul searching, was that I feared regret more than I feared failure. And so what I said to myself is, worst case scenario, I turn over some cards and I learn what it's like to be an entrepreneur. And that's going to fulfill me a lot more than staying at the law firm on the safer path and then wondering what could have been years down the line.
You then now become, I would say, part of the venture world with these folks. But one thing that is very interesting as part of that journey is you go from being a lawyer to now heading product out of all things. And then slowly, you know, you end up becoming the CEO. I mean, that's quite a, you know, shift of gears there when it comes to titles and responsibilities.
Yeah, you know, it was so my first startup was a company, Frontier Strategy Group, information services company, sold a subscription that helped organizations benchmark their performance, improve their performance in international and emerging markets. And so it was a business that I had very little experience in. On day one, it was three of us, the two founders and myself as the first hire. So saying I was the head of product sounds a bit lofty. I was really, you know, just sort of one of three people doing the work that came in as it came in. And then over time, as the business grew, I grew my career with the business. And so the ability to go from really what on day one was doing bespoke work for a couple of individual clients to then thinking about how do we build a scalable subscription offering to then, as you said, taking over as CEO of the business was a really important journey. And I think I had the benefit of growing with the business as opposed to stepping into a business that was already large and established. And so one of the things that I sort of say to younger folks who are thinking about their career is constantly put yourself in uncomfortable positions. I mean, there was throughout my entire run at Frontier Strategy Group, there was rarely a day where I felt like I've done this before and I know exactly what I should be doing. I was learning as I went. I was making mistakes. I was hopefully getting more things right than I was getting wrong. But ultimately, it's kind of like going to the gym and pushing yourself with a really hard set of workouts versus just kind of going through the motions. If you do that every day, you're going to get up the curve so much faster than your peers that are maybe taking a safer path. Well, I think about it, if I'd sit at the law firm, the conversations I was having, the clients I was meeting with, I would have never seen those folks. And I certainly would have never been in a room sort of leading conversations with them if I had stayed on the safer path.
So then I guess, what point does it become evident that it was time to start your own company? That's a mega, mega step.
Yeah, it both was and it wasn't. You know, when I think about the biggest moments in my career, the first decision to leave the law firm and join a startup probably felt bigger at the time because it was a whole change in professional identity. Whereas when I went from Frontier to start my own company, I already saw myself as an entrepreneur. Now, what was interesting is I'd never started a company before. So I did have some questions around, okay, if I was going to start something, what would I start? And does it make sense for me to start something? Or does it make sense to join a startup and take over as CEO and help them scale their business as I had done at Frontier? And so I learned a couple of valuable lessons before I talk about specifically why I started Tech Online. And the first is that we often have a tendency to define ourselves by our past experience. So because I had joined as the first hire and because I'd become CEO and helped build someone else's idea, the first thing you think is maybe I should do that again. And you know, when I started to step back and reframe, I said to myself, well, why wouldn't I want to start my own thing? Why wouldn't I want to bring a great idea into the world and scale it as opposed to taking someone else's idea? And when I reframed it, it opened up a whole set of possibilities that maybe wouldn't have been evident if I had sort of thought about my future based on what I had accomplished in the past. And so that sort of led me to Exec Online. I always had the idea in the back of my mind that I'd be interested in a business that solved the challenge that I heard repeatedly from executives at Frontier Strategy Group. So we would host roundtables for leaders all over the world. We'd have agenda, different topics on the agenda. And talent was always a top topic. And leadership capability was a top topic. And so when I left, I started to think about what could I build that would fundamentally help organizations develop leaders in a different kind of way and help leaders accelerate their career. And the more I learned about leadership development, the more I was surprised to find how few leadership development resources were available to the typical leader in an organization. There were a few people who got heavy levels of investment, but the vast majority of folks were not really being invested in from a leadership development perspective by their companies because all leadership development was happening in person. And so the idea behind Exec Online was, what if you could take leadership development, which traditionally everyone thought had to be done in person because you couldn't engage leaders online, what if you brought that online? And what if you did it in a way that was higher quality than what you could do in person? And the way we did that initially was by partnering with some of the best business schools in the world, having a very intentional methodology around how you develop world-class leadership programs, bringing those online, and then democratizing that access without sacrificing quality.
So how do you guys make money at Exec Online? What is the business? What ended up being the ultimate, you know, business model here?
Yeah, so we partner with many of the world's leading business schools. So schools like Berkeley and Columbia and Wharton and MIT, taking programs that traditionally before Exec Online would have been delivered purely on campus in their executive education group. So we're all non-degree certificate programs that you would call executive education. We partner with them to build Exec Online specific offerings that we host and deliver on our platform for the corporate enterprise. So we partner with schools, we sell to companies who then buy the programs we offer on behalf of leaders within their organization. And we now work with hundreds of companies. We develop tens of thousands of leaders every year. And we've expanded our offerings to include not only school partner programs, but our own proprietary programs and our own coaching capabilities. So effectively, we've become a one-stop shop for all leadership development needs from frontline managers up through the most senior leaders in the organization.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So With that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out. So I guess you guys have raised quite a bit of money too. So you were alluding to it earlier. You guys have raised about $110 million. So how has it been to the experience of raising money, and how have those financing cycles, how have they gone in parallel with the life cycles of the business, and how those expectations too have shifted from one cycle to the next?
Yeah, so one of the things that I think is really important when you're thinking about raising capital is, you know, to your point, where are you in the stage of your company and understanding what investors expect at different stages? So when you're raising a seed round, which, you know, is, in my view, both the most exciting time for the business and also the hardest capital to raise, you're raising it on an idea. You know, every great startup has to solve a number of chicken and egg problems. And the first problem you have to solve is, it'd be really great if I had some money to build something really cool. But in order to get that money, I've got to sell someone on a vision before it's built. And so for that stage, people, by and large, are just investing in you. When I talk to seed stage investors, the thing I hear pretty consistently is, yeah, the business idea needs to be a good one, and it needs to make sense. But fundamentally, I'm evaluating the person, because I assume they're going to pivot, the world's going to change, the business is going to change, and I'm betting on whether I think they're going to figure it out. And so that is fundamentally a very personal sale. By the time you get to the Series A, I think what investors tend to be looking for is product market fit. So you've gone out, you've proven there's something here, you've sold some customers, there's traction, the business has some early stages of growth. Then when you get to your kind of Series B, Series C, I think this is a mistake that a lot of young entrepreneurs make, is they go with the same pitch for their Series B and C that they did for their Series A. And it is a very different set of expectations. And the sort of way I think about it is, by the time you get to Series B and C, you have investors that are really starting to think about, okay, how are the economics of this model coming into focus? What are your retention rates? What is the lifetime value of your customer? What is your LTV to CAC? You know, all these things that then start to create the long-term view of how the economics of the business are likely to trend. And is this going to be an exciting growth, a growing profitable business over time? And then at the latest stages, you're starting to really have investors that are thinking about exit. So what are the likely paths? Is this an IPO? Is this an acquisition? If it is an acquisition, what does the acquisition market look like? What type of return am I going to get on that acquisition? And so I think understanding each one of those stages is really important. And through the life cycle of the Tech Online, we've gone through our Series E round. We've been able to tailor our message at critical moments, given those expectations of particular investor groups.
So then in that case too, you know, being a former lawyer, you know, and having that training to, you know, now that you're looking at it from the founder point of view, there's probably a lot of founders that are listening to us right now, and they're probably about to go through financing rounds, through deal making. What would you say are the three biggest things that a founder should keep in mind when it comes to legal, when going through those deals?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, you know, I will preface it by saying, and my general counsel would probably appreciate me saying this, I know just enough law at this point to commit malpractice. So take everything I'm saying with a grain of salt. But in all seriousness, I think founders tend to over-index on headline valuation. And the first question that everyone's got, well, what was the valuation? And that's really important. I mean, that is, don't get me wrong, that's a critical economic term. But there's so many other pieces that go into when you think about rights and preferences of investors that really determine what I would call the true valuation. So for example, if you get a, you know, $200 million pre-money valuation, but your investors have a heavy lick pref on top of it, then that's not really a $200 million valuation. And I would argue that you should pay a fair amount in valuation, headline valuation, to get that lick pref out of the deal, because ultimately that's going to make a big difference in terms of your own personal economics. But secondly, it's going to make a big deal in terms of your ability to do future rounds. So I think the second thing that a lot of founders underestimate is the extent to which complexity in one round, in addition to creating potential drag on your economics, also makes it harder for you to do future deals, because new investors like to come into a cleaner capital stack. And if they're coming into a messy capital stack, then they want certain rights and preferences, which just makes it more complex and it tends to snowball round to round. So as you're thinking about building your business, particularly in the earlier stages, one piece of advice is like try to make your rounds as clean as possible. The third thing I would say is think early on about ways that you as a founder can maintain control of your business as you bring on capital, right? So super voting rights are kind of one way to do that. That's something that we did at Exec Online. And what I would say is people often think about it too late. So in the earliest days of a business, when you're raising your seed round, if you put into your incorporation documents that you have 10x voting for your common shares, then most seed investors just don't care because they're investing in you anyway. It's like, it's, you know, whatever. It's already in the document. So when you incorporate initially, put that in there. And then once it's there, if your business is doing well and things are continuing to progress, most investors aren't going to make you take it out to do a deal. And so it kind of is in there. If you wait and try to do it later, no investor is going to go for it. So that'd be my third thing is think early and proactively about how you maintain control of your business as you take on more capital, even if you don't own a majority.
So let's say you were to go to sleep tonight, Stephen, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Exec Online is fully realized. What does that world look like?
That world looks like a world where there is much greater leadership mobility in organizations. People who enter organizations feel like they have a real path to leadership, no matter their background, whether they went to an elite school, whether they're in the right networks, whether they're, you know, male, female, what their race is, all the different axes of diversity. People have the opportunity to advance in organizations because high quality leadership development is available to them at scale as a benefit that every leader comes to expect and have access to. And that has been the opposite of what leadership development has been traditionally. It's traditionally been a tap on the shoulder resource for a handful of folks that have been selected because they're seen as high potential. And the 95% of people who aren't categorized that way have to kind of fend for themselves. And that creates self-fulfilling prophecies that aren't good for companies because they tend to have thinner leadership benches than they need in a world of significant change. And it obviously has a huge impact on the careers of really talented folks that with a little support could advance and accelerate to higher and higher levels of leadership, but are often trapped and kind of hit ceilings because they don't have access to the development that we all need to push our careers forward.
And we've seen a lot of shifts in the world that we're living in, no? Especially, you know, after we experienced COVID. So I guess with that in mind, what kind of leadership changes have we seen in the last couple of years?
Yeah, so I'll talk about leadership capabilities, and then I'll also talk about leadership development and how companies are thinking about it. From a leadership capability perspective, I think with COVID, you saw an acceleration of a trend that was already taking place, which is just that the half-life on leadership skills is always shrinking. And at the end of the day, there feels like there's a once in a 100-year event every year at this point, whether it's COVID, whether it's been, you know, the last bout of economic uncertainty, whether it's global wars, there's constantly shifting landscape under our feet that leaders have to react to in terms of both things that are happening inside their companies and outside of their companies. And so leaders, the pace of change and the pace of learning has to accelerate as a result. And so what I believe is that we're in a learning economy. And I think COVID really highlighted this, where success is increasingly determined by your ability to learn fast and the pace of change. The second big thing that we've seen is the need for leaders to be able to communicate and align in through different hybrid environments than they're used to in the past. Leaders were able to do everything largely in person. They basically had their teams around them. There were leaders that maybe ran international businesses that had to do a lot more virtual, but most leaders had the luxury of being co-located with the teams that they led. We're now in a world where you're sometimes in person, you're sometimes virtual, you often have teams that are hybrid, some in person, some virtual, and that requires different communication approaches, just in the same way that you know as a leader when to pick up the phone or hop on a Zoom versus sending an email. You also have to figure out how to lead a team that's all co-located versus a team that's spread all over the world. And I think that communication has become a key piece. And then I would say thirdly, especially with the rise of AI, alongside COVID, alongside economic downturn, the ability to make complex strategic decisions effectively is really important, because as there have been so many shifts in the world, COVID being a key one of them, decision-making has gotten pushed down in organizations because you just don't have the time for everything to flow up and back down. So leaders have to make more agile decisions with less than perfect information in a complex environment. So there's a lot of pressure on decision-making. What that's meant for, so that has meant that leadership as a capability and a priority is on the agenda of every organization, I think in ways that it hasn't been in the past. And then in addition to that, the obvious piece with COVID in our business is it took us from a world where every day we were working to convince companies that you could deliver high quality leadership development online as opposed to in person, to a world where overnight it all moved online. And so there was probably a decade of progress in that 1 to 2 year period with COVID of, you know, really taking the market from an in-person leadership development market to what is now primarily an online and hybrid leadership development.
So you've been pushing this now, Stephen, for over 13 years. And that in the corporate world, it could be like 150 years, right? So, which is unbelievable. So let's say I was to bring you back in time. I put you into a time machine and I bring you back to, let's say, 2011, which was the time where you were thinking about starting something of your own. And let's say I gave you the opportunity of just showing up right there, you know, and seeing your younger self and being able to give that younger self one piece of advice before starting a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
It's a great question. To me, the key to starting a business is to be have the right combination of a vision with the ability to pivot and be agile on the path to that vision. So I think you have some entrepreneurs that suffer from, they don't have a vision, they're doing stuff, but they're not really sure where they're going. And then you have some entrepreneurs who have a really clear vision, but the vision is almost too clear, and they think there's only one straight line path. And so in some ways, I analogize being a successful entrepreneur to whitewater rafting. You know where you want to get at the end, and it's about getting through the eddies. It's about knowing when to fight the current versus when to go with the current, and ultimately finding your way to the right destination. I feel like if I had to summarize what it takes, you know, in my 2011 self, looking forward to, and I've never started a company before, I joined as the first hire of a company. But I think about the person setting the vision, that was the big new thing for me. It was staying clear on what we wanted to accomplish. In many ways, that vision today is the same as it was back in 2011, but the ability to make your way through those eddies and not to fight the currents that you shouldn't fight, to figure out your way around them and to navigate to a good place is, I think, the art that goes with the science.
That's amazing. So I guess for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Hit me up on LinkedIn. Stephen Bailey, Exec Online. You'll find me pretty easily.
That's easy enough. Well, Stephen, I got to say thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. It's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.